I've always called myself a journeyman actor. I still am, and it's not been unmeaningless. My interview about actor Bill Windham is next on Fanicek. Hello, Fanicek listeners. This is another special episode of Fanicek. Today, I'm talking with Jenna Terranova Frisby. Now, Jenna is a big fan of actor William Windham. We'll be calling him Bill Windham. He was a journeyman actor. She's got williamwindham.com. She's got a William Windham tribute page on YouTube and on Facebook. She's working on a documentary with one of William Windham's daughters that'll be coming out here soon. I read a great book. It's called Journeyman Actor. It's a memoir by Mr. William Windham himself. So enjoy the interview. Away we go. Okay. I'm here with Jenna Terranova Frisby. We're going to be talking about William Windham. Very excited for this. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Welcome to Fanicek. I am your host. I'm Fanicek. So again, we're going to be talking about William Windham today. By the way, are you a William Windham or a Bill Windham kind of person? What would you prefer for today?
I guess Bill. I think he went by Bill more often than William.
Fair enough. I wanted to be respectful. Yeah, but I've noticed that too. He does go by Bill. So, you know, I read his book, which I'm holding here, Journeyman Actor, his memoir. What I thought I would do first is I'm going to run through a lot of his credits for my audience because I would imagine, like myself, not a lot of people know Bill Windham, but they certainly know the work. And I want to help give the audience, especially people listening to my show, more of an appreciation for his background on the acting side. And of course, we'll talk about other aspects of his life as well. But if you'll just indulge me for a minute, Jenna, I'll run through all this stuff. But Bill Windham, born September 28th, 1923. He passed at 88 years old, August 16th of 2012. 257 acting credits. His first was a 1949 episode of the Philco Television Playhouse. His final acting credit was a 2006 short film called Just. I want to go through his notable roles because he's got some really cool ones. This is the kind of stuff I talk about all the time. So he did episodes of Ben Casey, Cheyenne, The Donna Reed Show. He did a 1962 episode of The Lucy Show. Also in 1962, he did To Kill a Mockingbird. So he played the prosecuting attorney opposite to Atticus Finch, which is pretty neat. He was in Combat, which is featured in one of my favorite movies, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's seen on the bus that drives by, a big advertisement for Combat. Two episodes of The Twilight Zone, including the 1961 Five Characters in Search of an Exit, which is, that's iconic. You know, I think it's like every New Year's Day, they have that 24-hour, you know, Twilight Zone marathon. And that one you can always guarantee is going to be in there. He played the major. He also did another episode in 1963. What else? 77 Sunset Strip. I love that show. I've always said it's a cool show with a cool title. From 1963 to 1966, of course, he did 101 episodes of The Farmer's Daughter, which really brought him into America's living room every week. Big show, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Wild Wild West. He did The Fugitive in 1967, which I've told stories about that on my podcast. Also 1967, Star Trek, The Doomsday Machine. He played Commodore Decker, which if you know anything about Star Trek, you do one episode of Star Trek, you can make money off of that the rest of your career. So Custer, Bonanza, Mod Squad, Lancer, also Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. I actually have an old TV guide with Lancer featured on the top of it or in the front of it. 1968, he does Prescription Murder, which was a TV movie that basically led to the series of TV movies, Columbo. And I'm a big Columbo fan. I've got an autographed Peter Falk picture here in my office, as well as something I got for Christmas this year as a gift from my wife, is this cool print with all the killers from every Columbo episode. So it's kind of wild and you have to be really nerdy to even know what it is, but that was really exciting for me. And Columbo comes up a little bit later, but 1969, 1970, he does My World and Welcome to It, 26 episodes. I'm sure this will come up too, because he won an Emmy for this outstanding comedy series, outstanding performance by an actor and a leading role in a comedy series. So, he beat Bill Cosby, by the way, amongst other people. I'm assuming Bill Cosby, that must have been for I Spy. But 1971 is That Girl, The Virginian, All in the Family, Escape from Planet of the Apes. He played the president. Cannon, Cates County, Marcus Welby, MD. 1972 does another episode of Columbo, Short Fuse, which is a little reunion with Roddy McDowell, because Roddy McDowell, I know, is in all those Planet of the Apes movies. Ironside, Night Gallery, The Jimmy Stewart Show. I told you I was going to ramble on, so just so bear with me. Banachek, which is the namesake for my podcast. So I've also got an old TV guide with George Papardin from Banachek. Gunsmoke, 3 episodes of Love American Style, 5 episodes of The FBI, 4 episodes of Mission Impossible, one of my favorites. The Partridge Family, not one of my favorites. Tenafly, great show starring Jimmy Mack. I've talked about that quite a bit on my podcast. James McKeachin, I think I'm pronouncing that properly. He was known as Jimmy Mack. It was in the same vein as Banachek and Columbo, those kinds of things. Hawkins, which is a little reunion with Jimmy Stewart there. 2 episodes of Hawaii Five-0, SWAT, Mannix, The Streets of San Francisco. And by the way, the theme music for my podcast was modeled off of the theme for The Streets of San Francisco. The Bionic Woman, 2 episodes of McMillan and Wife, 2 episodes of Police Woman, Quincy M.E., Family, Kojak, Brothers and Sisters, which kind of was a competitor of Delta House, which was that horrible show that was based on Animal House. 2 episodes of Dallas, The Incredible Hulk, Foul Play, the TV show, which I just released an episode about that, which came out earlier this week. 3 episodes of Barney Miller. I grew up around Abe Vigoda, by the way. I grew up in the Bronx, and I used to see Abe Vigoda all the time as a kid. I was too young to really appreciate it, but I used to see him in the grocery store all the time. 1 Day at a Time, Fantasy Island, Heart to Heart, Trapper John MD, 3 episodes of The Love Boat, The Greatest American Hero, The A-Team, a 10-year-old me loved the A-Team, Mama's Family, Matt Houston, The Facts of Life. He was the heavy in Facts of Life. Not a lot of people get to say that. He tried to put Miss Garrett out of business. Imagine that, playing the heavy on Facts of Life. I love it. Saint Elsewhere, Simon and Simon, Hunter, Highway to Heaven, Hotel, Hardcastle McCormick, The Jetsons. He did voiceover work on The Jetsons. Airwolf, Knight Rider, Magnum P.I., arguably 3 of the coolest shows of the 80s. 1987 has Newhart with his pal Tom Poston. I know it came up in his memoir a couple of times that they had a relationship. I believe Tom Poston was like the dim-witted handyman in Newhart. Great actor. And then this was interesting. This did not come up in his memoir. I'm sure you know more about it than I do. He did Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. She's Having a Baby and Uncle Buck. So I wonder if there's a relationship with John Hughes there, because those are all John Hughes projects. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, one of my favorite movies of all time. I watch that every year around Thanksgiving. 2 episodes of Amen. I loved Amen. That was the Sherman Hemsley show that he did after The Jeffersons. It didn't get his recognition. I love that show. The TV show Parenthood. I'm actually about to record an episode about that. He played the Jason Robards role, the role that Jason Robards had in the movie. L.A. Law. He did more voiceover work with Batman, the animated series. What else did I write here? Camp Candy came up as VO work. So again, it's a John Candy project, and he did a couple of John Candy films. Bobby's World. Then he does Murphy Brown. He did the 1994 remake of Miracle on 34th Street. Of course, 53 episodes of Murder, She Wrote. He was Dr. Seth Hazlitt. Boy Meets World, True Crime with Clint Eastwood, Judging Amy, Adley McBeal, and JAG. I'm exhausted. So that was just some of the notable roles. And again, thank you for indulging me, Jenna. I promise you the whole episode won't be just me yammering on and you having to suffer through it. But I wanted to give my audience just a feel for who this man was as a working actor. Because this is the kind of stuff I talk about all the time. These are the roles I talk about all the time, the shows, the projects. So I'm excited to jump in and learn more about him. So the one thing that I've been wanting to ask you, Jenna, since you and I started corresponding, I said, hey, I'm going to get his book and read about him, and then I want to do an episode with you, simply is this. Why Bill Windham? What drew you to him?
You know, it's interesting. I'm often drawn to actors who have sort of a natural sort of way about them. And maybe they're not the ones that are, you know, listed as the star of something. They're maybe the co-stars or the second banana. And I like that about him. And he was often sort of the co-star of a story, especially, you know, in Murder, She Wrote. And that's what I had known him from additionally. And then as I watched more of those shows, I wanted to learn more about what other shows did he do and what was he like. And then I started going down the rabbit hole, and he had so many appearances that, you know, I just kept finding them, and I just snowballed into the website.
Interesting. Yeah. You know, one of the things, and really all I know is just from mostly from the memoir, like I said, which, you know, he wrote with someone. I'm assuming you've read that memoir.
I've seen bits and pieces, believe it or not. I have not read it. And an interesting point that came up with his daughter when I was talking to her, she didn't know about it.
Wow.
He didn't know it had been published.
Well, let me ask you then, because that leads to something I was curious about anyway. He doesn't, in the memoir, doesn't talk a whole lot about his family or even his personal life, really. I mean, I know about some of his upbringing, his military time. I mean, he mentions having been married, but he doesn't talk a lot about his family. Was there a falling out? I mean, how would his daughter not know about this? Did he not have a great relationship with her or with all of his children? Or
no, he did have a great relationship. And I mean, this is his second daughter. So he had four children and two stepdaughters, mm-hmm. and they were always, you know, even after the divorces, always in each other's lives, very close. And this was his second daughter. And she was always, in fact, all the kids sort of lived at the time before he died, you know, no more than a few miles from him. And she knew he was working on an autobiography. And I don't know if it's just that, you know, that he didn't really discuss it constantly with her, but she knew about it. And then she mentioned that there was something that had gone on with the co-writer, and she didn't think the project went through, and she was surprised that it had been published.
Oh, okay.
And then she got a copy of it a few months ago.
What did she think of it, if you don't mind me asking?
I know she told me she gave it to a friend of hers. Like you mentioned, it didn't dwell a lot on his personal side, because he really didn't like to talk about himself a lot. Or anything personal. He really liked to talk about the business and how he got into it and sort of advise people that want to get into it.
Yeah. You know, he seems to have an interesting relationship with his career. At times he felt comfortable with it. At times he seemed almost blasé about it. And then there's maybe, I sensed maybe some bitterness, or maybe he wished he had achieved more. I mean, what's your take on it?
Yeah, his daughter mentioned a little bit of that too. You know, sometimes he wanted to be not just the co-star or the second banana, but you know, and there were certain. I mean, he was very easy to work with. People enjoyed working with him. He wasn't one of these people that tried to commandeer a set or anything like that. And he was a jokester. I mean, he cracked up constantly. He liked to play practical jokes. He was like a teenager, essentially, when it came to his personality, loved life. So he didn't take acting that, you know, seriously. I'm this thespian. He did anything that came down the pike, but I think sometimes he wanted more media roles and he just got, you know, looked beyond and they went for someone else. Like a lot of times, a lot of his famous roles, he was not the first choice.
Right.
And then in some movies he would go for, they went with someone else. So I'm sure that was hard for him.
Yeah, I can imagine. Cause a lot of the stuff cause he had major success. I mean, The Farmer's Daughter is a big deal, cause back then there were only the three channels, you know, and he's on a successful show. And that didn't seem to translate to like another show or getting the lead on another program. And then, of course, there's the Emmy win, which was big, you know, My World and Welcome to It, which also didn't seem to translate. You know, do you think there was a reason for that? Did he hurt his own career, or was he not playing the game?
I think he mentioned that too, that, yeah, you sort of have to play a game. And that just wasn't him. You know, he wasn't the type that went to the red carpet events or, you know, rubbed elbows with famous people. And maybe that did affect the roles he got. But, you know, he just loved acting so much. He was just happy, you know, doing whatever he could. And, you know, I think his favorite was My World and Welcome to It. I think he really liked that role because it gave him this ability to do things that he normally wouldn't probably do in previous sitcoms. And that's why he took it on the road with him and toured colleges and universities and he went to Europe where he did these one-man shows based on the Thurber material. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for those who don't know, yeah, he did that for years, right? I mean, was it almost 30 years maybe? I mean, I feel like it was a long time of doing the Thurber show.
Yeah, he sort of, it was Thurber, and he balanced it with Ernie Pyle, the war correspondent. So he created one-man shows based on Ernie Pyle. Yeah, and and, you know, it was just him and maybe a desk and some lighting, and that, you know, and that's all he needed.
Yeah, that sounds like a grind. I mean, it was fascinating to me that he created the show and would travel so much with it. Of course, it kind of dwindled over time, but he did it for so long. And there's an interesting thing in the memoir that talks about once he got booked on that cruise ship, where they didn't give him a stage or platform to do Thurber, he had to walk around, just kind of interact with guests. I mean, it sounds awful. I just felt bad for him reading that part of it. I don't think he knew what he was getting into with that one. But yeah, the one-man show stuff just sounded grueling. That's a labor of love, I'm sure, because it's not a huge moneymaker. So Thurber was who the show was based on, correct? My World, Welcome to It?
Yes, his cartoons.
Right. That's right. There was the cartoons. Okay. Yeah, and he created that show. Yeah, that was fascinating stuff. And he even talks about, he recommends to all young actors that they do that, create a one-person show and perform it. I mean, that's tough. That's hard to hold an audience that long. It's a lot to remember. It's just a lot of work. And that was an interesting part of his career. But he did. He sprinkled it in with these great roles that he did. When did you start your journey with Bill Windham? When did this start for you?
In early 2020. When I started looking at going online and YouTube and finding his other appearances, and then going through newspaper articles and magazines.
Okay. Have you seen all of his work or no?
I would say probably 90% of it, of what's available on film. And I've been trying to archive that for his family. So I've been able to get some stuff that's at UCLA, University of Georgia, because they've had material through the Peabody Collection. I've been able to cull a lot of this archive material that's not out there.
Right. Are you going to publish it anywhere, or are you just giving it to his family?
I've been giving it to his family. A lot of it, you know, you get involved with the copyrights and ownerships and things like that. So it's kind of hard to use that material without having to pay a lot of money for licensing.
How did you get in touch with his family? I know you obviously have a relationship with one of his daughters, which we'll talk about, but.
Yeah. So, you know, I sent out letters to all of his family members, letting them know about the website or emails, and then showing them the pictures and clips from the website, and then collecting his appearances and holding them, you know, on a big hard drive. And then putting them on like USB sticks and saying, you know, would you like to see this material? Maybe you didn't know about this just before you were born, or maybe, you know, growing up, you didn't sit in front of the TV, and he certainly didn't watch himself. So his daughter reached out to me, and then I said, you know, would you like to share stories about your dad? And she said, sure. And we've been kind of doing these Zoom calls.
Okay. Which daughter?
That's his second daughter, Heather.
Heather. Okay. So yeah, Heather and Hope. Right. And yeah. Okay. I had to go back and kind of look into this stuff because he didn't really mention it in the book, but again, the book was more about work. What do you think he would say is his crowning achievement, like his best role, or what would he want to be remembered for?
Role wise? I think he always said, believe it or not, was the very first acting role he ever got, which was when he was in the military. Mm. And he was at the school in France that the military had established for soldiers that were transitioning. And he accidentally got a role in the Shakespeare play. And it was interesting how he, Richard III.
Right, Richard III.
And he originally got a role in it, and that was totally by hapstance, because he tried out and he made a mockery and they said, get out. And he somehow talked his way into a second audition. And I think he got a small role. And when the star left to go back to the U.S., because at that time they brought actors in to train these soldiers, like Marlene Dietrich.
Oh, wow.
And so it was Richard Worf, this actor who did Richard III, and then he had to go back to the U.S. for a show he was doing. And Bill somehow got the lead. And he thought that was the greatest thing. It was a heavy, it was fun to do. So no matter what he did in his career, that was like his favorite, 21-year-old Bill Windham doing Richard III.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah. He talked about that in the book. You know, obviously the military time to Richard III came to the States and was part of the invited to join the American Repertory Theater Company. What jumped out at me about that was that he was friendly with Eli Wallach, and that's one of the people, I guess, who helped get him in. I love Eli Wallach. I mentioned him a bunch on the podcast. One of my favorite movies is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Eli Wallach plays Tuco, which I love. It's a short little Jewish man, but playing this Mexican outlaw. It's just a great role, great movie. But yeah, I mean, he never considered – so he comes to here, and he had a Broadway career prior to going out to L.A. He was actually working in New York for a long time before going out to L.A., but he never considered himself a success. I actually even wrote this down. He said that 45 to 50% of what he did was crap. Like 45 to 50% of what I've done is crap. And he makes a lot of comments like that. And I don't know. Sometimes I took it, you know, I saw the funny in that, but I just thought maybe there was some pain there too. You know, I mean, you know, you couldn't always laugh.
Yeah. He loved using percentages on everything. He would compare his career or life. Everything is, you know, 90% crap and 5% good. And I always thought that was interesting. I mean, he was a genius. He was a member of Mensa. So he was always thinking. And yeah, I think he had a self-deprecating humor about himself.
That's interesting. I didn't know he was in Mensa. Mm-hmm. How did I'm embarrassed. That's pretty wild. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, you know, what is your favorite role of his? We've talked about what his is, the Richard III stuff. What do you love?
I, believe it or not, I like The Farmer's Daughter, which wasn't his favorite. But I thought it was, most of the scripts I think were well written. It's just a kind of a feel-good sitcom. And, you know, it was sort of a very milquetoast kind of role for him and boring that he would often talk about. But there were sides to his character that came out. There were a couple of dream sequence episodes where he really got to be really funny and silly and serious and heroic and romantic. So I don't know. I just like that 60s kind of sitcom. That's my favorite.
No, I get it. I've been recently rewatching Hazel because I had done an interview with Ron DeFore, who's Don DeFore's son. And yeah, there is something nice about those, you know, the innocence of them, that they're not complicated. You know, you can kind of just enjoy them. But I totally get that. Yeah, it's funny. I was wondering if he was going to talk more about Inger Stevens, and he really didn't. She had a tragic end, you know, lifelong battle with depression. But yeah, I think he referred to himself in that role, and then other roles. I forget the line that he used, but he called them like they went that way roles, like I think that's how he phrased it, of just, again, like being a second or third banana and just, you know, not adding a whole lot to the scene. But yeah, no, great. And again, that's why I was interesting, because I mean, to be a lead in a show that big, because it was a big show, because again, I mean, there really wasn't that much content. It's three networks, you know, but it didn't translate. I would have thought maybe would have led to, you know, another long running series, and it really didn't for him, which is unfortunate. But he had a lot of great TV work. I mean, but he also seems to have an interesting relationship with his agents. Like, I don't think he had any agents that he seemed like he was fond of. I mean, they were clearly getting him work, but it was a funny read. I really enjoyed reading about him. He didn't take himself too seriously. I wish he had been more successful, of course. But let's talk a little bit about, I know you're working on a documentary with one of his daughters. I guess that's Heather, you said. Yes. So let's talk about that. What's that going to be about? What's it called? Any details you want to give us?
So, I mean, I have a working title, which was, it's called It's Not Unmeaningless, which is a phrase from Thurber that he really liked. And I want to do, you know, a little bit biography, but more trivia that people maybe never knew about, and taking it from, you know, his autobiography, his interviews, and then looking at what he was like as the dad, as the husband, and that's through the eyes of his daughter, Heather.
Do you want to share any of that, those tidbits with us? One or two nuggets that maybe we don't know about?
Yeah. You know, she says, you know, he was really a jokester. He loved life because of what he saw in World War II. And he sort of came back with this idea that, you know, if I could survive World War II, then anything else in life is, you know, chocolate cream pie. So he never got depressed really a whole heck of a lot, you know, because he could always find the bright side of something. And, you know, he loved his children. He loved raising them and teaching them things. And He was definitely, other than when he had to travel, he really was the father that was there teaching the kids how to drive, teaching them chess, playing with them on the floor with their toys. And that's really cool. I mean, you don't think about that.
That will be fun to see, because again, the book doesn't go into that. It's mostly about his work. I mean, he does mention chess. He mentions sailing. I think he had a passion for sailing. I had no idea he was in Mensa. So he had a great relationship with his kids, which I would have assumed he didn't, honestly. So I'm kind of glad you clear that up for me, because with them not being mentioned, I was kind of left wondering about that. I had a couple things I want to ask you about with him. You talked about, you know, obviously your favorite project of his is I'm sorry, I'm reading my notes, I have bad handwriting, but your favorite project of his is this, The Farmer's Daughter. When you fast forward though, you said you discovered him though through Murder, She Wrote. He didn't seem terribly interested in Murder, She Wrote.
I think again, it was that sort of, you know, like you said, went that away kind of role where uh-huh. he was just kind of the associate that was there to sort of fill in scenes. He did definitely have a lot of fun hearing stories from, you know, Ron Masak and his children about, you know, the jokes Bill would play on the set and just his quirky personality.
Yeah. I've talked about this on the podcast before. I've never seen Murder, She Wrote. I just didn't appeal to a younger me. But I mean, whatever I was watching everything I watched, like, was the lead-in for it, because I've seen the opening credits of Murder, She Wrote thousands of times. I don't know if it was just on all the time or what, but every show I watched apparently was a lead-in for Murder, She Wrote. I never saw it, but it fascinated me that he did so many episodes of it. Angela Lansbury was interesting. You know, she did a lot for aging actors. She always made sure to bring in aging actors so they keep their benefits and through the union and all that. So I really appreciate that about her. What was the last few years of his life like? Because I think his last project was 2006, but he died 6 years later. Do you know, can you fill in any of the gaps there?
I think, you know, he started to sort of step back, I think, away from the spotlight and work less, do less of the one-man shows and just kind of take it easy. And then he would do, you know, an appearance here and there, like on JAG. Mm-hmm. And things like that. And he did his last movie, I believe, was a full length feature in 2004, which was called Yesterday's Dream. And, you know, it was a small independent project. And the actor and the writer and the director reached out to him. And, you know, he agreed to do it and fly up to, I believe it was shot in Oregon, and do the role. And then the last role was a student film from a student at USC. Wow. And again, you know, he was so accessible.
That's interesting. Yeah. I spent some years as an actor in LA, and yeah, if it weren't for student films, in those early years, my resume would have been empty. And I never did one as prestigious as USC, but my wife went to USC. Actually, she was a theater major at USC. So I know the school well. He was married 5 times, which I don't have to dive into all that. But one thing that I did notice, and again, I'm just curious about this. One of his wives, I think his third wife, was, according to what I saw online, was the granddaughter of Louis B. Mayer. How did that not translate into some wealth?
Yeah, you know, that's really interesting. And then so he had, so that wife had 2 daughters.
Right. Those were his 2 stepdaughters. Okay.
Yes. So I have spoken with both of them as well. And, you know, nothing but wonderful memories of growing up for that time with Bill. And neither of them really know the story of how they met. It might have been at a Hollywood party. And it was really interesting because Bill was so down to earth and very very simple things. He still had food rations from World War II. And he would just like pop those open and eat them. Okay. Oh. That was the thing. So eat grits and wear, you know, sandals or go barefoot, drive a Volkswagen. And he and his wife lived on this beautiful house in Malibu on the beach. And it's jokingly, she had a Ferrari, he had a VW. And it was just really interesting. Like, they were these two sort of different people from different walks of life that came together. And it was just so funny that, yeah, he didn't get, you know, like a lot of those big Hollywood roles other than, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah. Yeah. And even that, I mean, it was obviously, I mean, he's obviously worked with Gregory Peck, but I think it was, yeah, I don't think Robert Duvall wouldn't have been in any of those scenes. I'm trying to think back to the movie. I don't know if I've ever seen the movie. I've read the book, but I don't recall Robert Duvall's character being in the courtroom scenes. I think it was probably just Gregory Peck. But again, still, it's a big, big project. And yeah, it seems like he was always there. He was always on the cusp. I mean, The Farmer's Daughter, you know, then like you said, To Kill a Mockingbird, My World, Welcome to It. Gosh, even Murder, She Wrote, you know, 53 episodes. That was a big show. That's a lot of episodes to do. It's nice to see that he still has a great relationship with the kids. Are any of the kids in entertainment, have any of them pursued acting or any kind of stuff in the biz?
No, they didn't have any kind of interest in that. I know he mentioned, Heather mentioned that as a surprise, and this was the kind of guy he was, said, you know, Heather, you know, put on something nice. Come on with me. We're going to go for a drive. And she didn't know what it was for. And it was, I think, when he was filming She's Having a Baby, and he brought her on the set to meet Kevin Bacon. So,
oh, that's pretty cool.
Kind of daddy was just like, yeah, come on, let's go. We'll go for a ride. And, you know, great things like that.
Let's talk about that thing, because that was on my list of things to bring up. Did he have a relationship with John Hughes? Because that was a lot of John Hughes projects right there in a row. And then later on, the Camp Candy thing with John Candy.
You know, it's kind of interesting. I think he mentioned that John Hughes liked to do interesting things and work with interesting people and kind of keep the camera rolling to see what kind of reactions he would get. So he was in The Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. Obviously, that was the big one, even though he didn't have any speaking roles. He just kind of sat there flustered.
But still a great role, because yeah, he's driving Steve Martin nuts. Oh, and Kevin Bacon's in that too, by the way. Yeah, I forgot. He has that cameo. Yeah, okay.
Yep. So I think actually, from what I learned from Heather, they filmed She's Having a Baby first. And then when that was done, I think it was either Kevin Bacon or John Hughes said, can you just make this quick appearance in this new film I'm doing called Planes, Trains, and Automobiles? And that's how Kevin Bacon got that little cameo.
Sure.
But Planes, Trains, and Automobiles was released first, and then She's Having a Baby came out, even though it was, the filming was the reverse. And then he did Uncle Buck, but it was a voice.
Yeah, voiceover. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So
and there's no indication that he had a relationship with John Hughes or anything like that?
Not that I'm aware of. I think it was just one of those situations where, I guess, if John Hughes kind of liked you and he had a good relationship, that he kind of used you more than once.
Got you. What about any other acting friends? Because in the book, you know, we mentioned Eli Wallach, and I know Tom Poston, who, again, Tom Poston, he did really well in the 80s with New Heart. I mean, I have several nominations, I believe, if I'm not wrong. But those two gentlemen, anyone else that maybe wasn't in the book that he had relationships with throughout his career?
I know he was very close with character actor Henry Jones, who did a lot in the 70s, usually playing a lot of the curmudgeon kind of roles. Their relationship went back to the American Repertory Theater, and they would do summer stock. They would drive to Pennsylvania and do summer stock. Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. He was the best man at his second wedding. So, and obviously Bill did about 4 episodes of FBI.
That's right.
Or 5 episodes. So they were close. Larry Hagman. Bill's stepdaughter would say that, you know, on the weekends, Larry Hagman and the family would come by the beach house. Carl Betts from the Donna Reed Show. They were good friends too.
Interesting. Hmm. I like Larry Hagman. Oh, all right. Wow. Where's the Emmy? Does anyone know where that is?
I believe Heather said Bill's wife still has the Emmy.
Okay.
But he used to joke that, you know, I read interviews when he was nominated and won, and then years later. And it's interesting how different they were. I mean, he wanted it. Like he said, he wanted that trophy so badly. And then years later, he looked back and he said, that was kind of, I don't know. He goes, that was so superficial, and used to use it as a doorstop in his dressing rooms. So,
yeah, he mentioned that. He did mention that he wanted it bad, though. It's funny to know that he did. He, in the book, he sounded very blasé about it. you know. So I know you're working on the documentary. And what's the timeline of that coming out?
I don't have a timeline yet. I'm still kind of procuring the interviews and the material I'm going to use. It's very bare bones, Blair Witch style, almost. Because I'm fashioning it more almost like stuff that you see from 60 Minutes or CBS This Morning, because I worked in TV for 10 years. So it's going to almost have it's not going to have bells and whistles, not a lot of special effects, but because I want the interviews to drive the story.
Okay. Tell us about the website. I mean, that has to be a labor of love. That's a lot. And you said you started this journey in 2020. So that's been the last couple of years then, huh? Of building that site?
Yes. And, you know, I'm always looking out for anything that's out there on the internet that pops up, any pictures or articles to add to it. You know, and trying to get as much information as I can on a lot of his appearances that, you know, are featured in his autobiography or it's out there on the internet, but maybe not a lot of details, you know, and I'm finding scripts. I'm trying to find certain episodes that aren't even archived and find out details about his appearances that just can't find because, you know, the TV shows aired once and never aired again and slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. A lot of early stuff got recorded over too. I'm not sure if any of his did, but yeah, I feel like it was was it Lucille Ball? Might've been like Desi Lu. They were the first ones to realize that that's a commodity. Don't, you know, you can rerun it. But early television never occurred to people that you could rerun things. They just kept recording over it. And I think it was like Deadly Productions was one of the first ones saying, no, we're going to keep this and ultimately rerun it. And then you can make money from that. And yeah, it was a whole thing. But so great. So we got the website, williamwyndham.com. The documentary is being worked on. That'll be coming out. And you're working with, you said, Heather on that one. What about his son, Rebel, by the way? Cool name. What's Rebel up to?
That's Bill. He wanted something that was easily rolled off the tongue and was different. So Rebel Russell, his only son. And actually, I talked to Heather. Rebel lives with his mom, Bill's fifth wife. Rebel is on the autism spectrum.
Okay.
And so went to special schools and things like that. And so I know I haven't talked to him. Heather, keeps in contact with him. So he and his mom live together on that. But like I said, none of the kids ever really had an interest in pursuing acting or anything like that. Lead typical, normal lives, things like that.
Well, so you, are there any other actors or personalities they have this kind of passion for, or is it strictly Mr. Wyndham?
He's at the top. I do have a similar passion for the late actor Ed Platt, whose most famous role was the chief in Get Smart. I did do a really bare bones website on him many years ago and had reached out to his family to let them know about that and collected a lot of his appearances too.
Gotcha. Well, again, I want to thank you for doing this. You got williamwyndham.com. We'll look forward to the documentary. One parting question. I mean, if you could have seen anything different for Bill Wyndham or a project, or I mean, how would you, if you could rewrite any of his story, would you? Anything you'd like to add or?
Probably not, because he was just, yeah. I mean, so many words describe him and he had so many dimensions that, yeah, maybe see him in, maybe one of those big roles that he tried to go out for and didn't get. I'll just impart this little information. There's a film called The Young Lions, black and white film about World War II that stars Marlon Brando. He wanted a role in that, and he tried to get the role by contacting the producer's secretary and supposedly wrapping the letter of introduction in an inert grenade. I don't know if that destroyed any chances of him getting an audition or scared, the heck out of the secretary, but that's the kind of person he was.
It sounds about right. Yeah.
And maybe he would have been great in one of those big roles, but that's the only thing probably.
I was going to wrap it up, but then let me ask, are there any other big roles that he didn't get that I don't know about? Like, were there any near misses like that could have been life-changing?
Not that I'm aware of. I know there were a few movies he didn't really get into details that, you know, he went out for and then just didn't get. And like a lot of his roles, his famous roles, like The Twilight Zone, The Major, the Commodore Decker, his other favorite role, Tim Riley's Bar from Night Gallery, he was all not even a thought to star in those roles. You know, Hapstance, Accidents. For Tim Riley, it was the director who had worked with Bill on The Farmer's Daughter that said, hire him for this role or I'm not going to direct the show. So, so he was never considered, you know, to be a star for those big roles. He was sort of a second thought.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, you know what? For a second thought, he put together a hell of a resume. It was a lot of fun learning about him. I'm glad I read the book. I'm glad I got to go through his credits. I mean, my gosh, like I said, some of those are some of my favorite shows. So now I got to go back and rewatch them. You know, I was the first thing I noticed that caught my eye was I was so excited about The Planes, Trains, and Automobiles because I know that scene so well. I mean, it opens the movie, you know. And but again, thank you for doing this. Is there anything that you want to shout out? Anything anywhere we can find you? I don't know if you do the whole Twitter thing, or I know you're on Facebook.
Yep, I have a Facebook page for him called William Wyndham Tribute, and I have a lot of his appearances on the William Wyndham Tribute on YouTube.
William Wyndham Tribute on YouTube. Excellent. Jenna, thank you for doing Fanacheck. I really appreciate it. It's been a pleasure getting to talk to you, and hopefully get a chance to do this soon.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, thank you. Okay, folks, thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed that conversation and learned more about Mr. Wyndham. I'll tell you what, so if you want to learn more about Jenna, it's Jenna Terranova Frisbee. You can find her on Facebook. She's got williamwyndham.com, a great resource for all things William Wyndham. There's also a William Wyndham tribute page on both YouTube and Facebook. Also, the book I read, Journeyman Actor, a memoir by Mr. Wyndham himself, you can find it on Amazon. Great read, a lot of fun. Now, for my info, of course, I am Fanacheck. You can email me, fanacheckpodcast@gmail.com. I'm giving out stickers. I'm giving out virtual hugs. I take requests. If you want to be on the podcasts, hit me up. I'd love to speak with you. You can find me on Twitter, Fanacheck Podcast, at Fanacheck Podcast, rather. I'm on Facebook, Real Fanacheck. I've got a bunch of you as friends. I look forward to making more friends. And again, feel free to hit me up. Leave a positive review if you like the podcast. That would be helpful. And as always, stay tuned for the next exciting episode of Fanacheck.